We don't need to say anything except that we're recording right now, and this is a Two Dimension Comic Book Podcast, the comic book podcast with no direction. I am Al, you are
Don,
and we are all together, kind of like a Beatles thing there, you know, but so welcome to episode 63. All right, so we got a lot of stuff on this show. I think we're going to talk about that and that and this and that. So I think we should get started.
One of my favorite comics is a strip called Rojo Vargas by Daniel Torres, which I, for some reason, I was thinking he was a Spanish artist.
Is it Rocco or Rocco?
Could be Rocco. I okay. Say Rocco. Yeah, okay. I guess it could be Rocco.
I don't know. Just asking.
You seem to know.
I don't know. I'm just asking. I don't know.
The first time I ever saw it, it was a serialized in Heavy Metal magazine in 1984 called Trident. And it was about a writer, a science fiction writer called Armando Mistral. And he wrote about a science fiction character called Sam Norton. And the style was really Art Deco. It was a really stylized Art Deco style. And I just loved it. It was being serialized in Heavy Metal the same time as the Third Inkle chapter was being serialized. And on the ship, they sold Heavy Metal, and every time...
Really?
Yeah.
There was a newsstand on the ship?
Yeah, they had five stores on the ship. They had the Hawk Shop, which is... They sold cigarette lighters, uniforms, cologne, watches, you know, jewelry, that kind of stuff, electronics. They had a toiletry store, which basically, you know, toothpaste, shaving cream, razor blades, batteries, you know, just little things like that. And they had a comic book rack, a spinner rack. It was usually stripped clean and just had a few comics in it that, you know, but... And when the magazines would come in, they always had Playboy and Penthouse.
Of course.
And they had a National Lampoon and Heavy Metal.
No comics.
Well, no, they had a spinner rack with comics.
Oh, pretty neat, man.
But you know, like I said, it wasn't a whole lot, and they were pretty, you know. It was on the ship. It was like locusts. As soon as something came on, the crew would buy up everything, and there'd just be very little left. But Heavy Metal and National Lampoon, along with Playboy and Penthouse, was all over the place. Everybody read them. But every time I would read Heavy Metal...
Read them or looked at the picture? Well, I guess on the ship, if you're there for 3 months, you're going to read it.
But, I would always read Triton and Inkle, and every time I'd read it, it didn't matter who, some guy on my ship, or oh yeah, I always read that, and I read this one. It was always those two in Heavy Metal everybody read. But I loved the strip. Armando Mistral was a science fiction writer, and as the strip went on, found out he really was the spaceman hero called Rocco Vargas. And his background, he was trying to forget, kept coming back. There was a water shortage on the planet Earth, and all these things happened. But it was very global, and it always reminded me of a cartoonist like Carl Barks did a science fiction story, or a Buck Rogers, Flash Gordon-type story. That's what it would have been like. But even though it was drawn in a clear-line style, it had adult themes. It had nudity. It had reference to drugs and espionage and all kinds of stuff. He brought the strip back later. There was a second one called Whisper. I can't remember what the third one was, but the last one he did, which tied everything up, was called Saxon, which is the one I asked you to read.
Mm-hmm.
And as he went on, he got a little more comfortable with the style. It continued to evolve, but on Saxon, to me, it was like the perfect story. Dark Horse put all four of them out in one big hardback, oversized hardback, which is, to me, it's just something everybody should have. They put it out, I think, 1998 or 99, but it's all four stories, and it builds up all the way in. To me, I just love how he told the story, and I can't say enough about it. Anyway, your thoughts on Rocco Vargas?
I like the art. I read part of the Saxon story. I like the art. I found the story a little hard to understand, but I'm going to give it another read and see. But just saying that, kind of, I'm being a little bit pejorative, because I'm going to talk about it later, about clarity in storytelling and art, and as opposed to, you know, just nice art and a hard to read story, but I think it's a nice book. I mean, it looks really good. The art is very stylized, but it's very interesting. And yes, there are adult things. You know, there's drugs. There's like an orgy in there. There's all sorts of bizarre stuff going on in there. So yeah, I definitely enjoyed it. And I will read it completely again. I'll talk more about it next time we do a show.
Yeah.
He was one of the guys, and I gotta be honest with you, because that's what our show is all about, honesty. He's one of the guys in heavy metal that I didn't read. I'd always go for the Corbin stuff. I'd always read the Morbius stuff, and maybe if they had another American artist, I would latch on to him. But there was always some artists that I just didn't gravitate toward for whatever reason. He's one of them. But now when I look at it again, when you give me a volume of it, and I look at it again without other people, you know, around it, it looks a lot better to me than I remember it being. And that's the case with a lot of artists for me, you know. Not necessarily, it's like with Creepies, when you had like an artist like Telerico and you had all these other artists around him, you gravitate towards other styles, which is what happens with an anthology magazine. And you may pick on some people that you like better than others and you might put them, you know, whatever. But yeah, it's definitely a really nice book. And are those Dark Horse volumes, the ones that you have?
Yeah, what happened, the reason we're talking about this was...
These aren't Dark Horse. These are...
Dark Horse.
Oh, these are Dark Horse. What's that big... Is that a Dark Horse also? Oh, okay. All right.
Dark Horse put out the big one, you know, the four previous stories. But then sometime in the 2000s, Dark Horse put out, you know, European-style hardbacks of Rocco Vargas again. I didn't know he was doing new stories. I bought them in a closeout rack in Manhattan. And I was so excited about it, but his style, again, continued to evolve. And some of the characters he had in it were a little racist. You know, he had these people from, I'm guessing they were from Mars. They were green. But he was drawing them like people. He used to draw black people in, you know, the 20s.
I saw that in that Saxon story, yeah.
And, he changed the character. It was like Ebony in the Spirit. You know, he used to draw him that way. And, I guess, you know, it is racist, but at the time, that was the conceived thing for a comic strip, and everybody showed it, and now it's just unthinkable. Well, I guess he decided that, too, because he's changed it. Now the green character, Samson, looks more like a boy.
So did he do it to make a point, or was that just his stereotypical? What years were those done in? That would be a good question for
you. Well, the book you read, it was all in the 80s. I think he might have started it in the late 70s, but it came over to the United States in 84.
Okay.
And then it finished in 88. So he's doing them every 4 years, or every year.
Mm-hmm.
But then these other three came out for Dark Horse again, and those were in the 2000s. So I don't know exactly what the year was he did them in Spain, but they came over here, you know, 20 years later.
So he lives here now?
I don't know.
Oh, okay.
I would assume not. But he,
because those things are translated.
Yeah, they're translated. He, his style though, it looks to me a lot more like Charles Burns.
And it does look like Charles Burns, yes.
And but
a little more fluid than Charles Burns, and a little more like, it's almost like it's Charles Burns and I don't know, somebody like Will Eisner got together and had an artist child. That's it.
Well, I was kind of excited to get these. I bought all three of them, and I read the first one. And the story was really vague. They were making references to what happened before. And I guess he was kind of letting you know why it changed. You know, that was then and this is now. But I honestly didn't enjoy it, and I was kind of wishing I hadn't bought these.
The Rocco Vargas.
No. Well, not the first one, the newer ones.
The newer ones, okay.
Well, I never read the other two. I've had them for a couple of years now. And then last week I pulled them out, so I need to read it again. So I read the second book of it, and it was about basically illegal robot fighting.
Mm.
And it started out with Isaac Asimov's Three Laws of Robots. You know, the Astro Boy always started out with.
Oh, yeah.
You know, your job is to serve and protect. You can't kill a human, nor can you hurt another robot or cause any destruction like that. And, basically, it has these people that they've taken these robots and destroyed the program, and they're called bastards. And then, you know, it's like cockfighting or dogfighting, but they're doing it with robots, which is illegal. And Rocco Vargas gets involved in it. Even though the style's a little bit different, I enjoyed it just as much. Well, this is great. So I grabbed the next one and read that. And it goes along more of the same. It's got another robot, but it turns into, it's called the Game of Gods. No, Walking the Monsters. And it's basically this other character following around. And he's the type of synthetic robot. He's like an organic grown. And there's a planet with all these people on it. I guess there must be about 20 of them. They're all tied into one type hive mind. And he's there to learn. And like I said, it was pretty unique. And one thing I always loved about this guy was he'll have panels. Kind of like Jack Kirby would have these giant spreads with all this stuff going on in them. He does the same thing. But he's got like these asteroid cities with all these subways and electric cars flying around and people doing stuff everywhere. He'll have panels of a city by the sea, and it shows right where the sea's at. There's all these big ships and boats and stuff. Then it goes underwater, and you see these aquatic people underneath the water and all these little submarines and stuff. It's like he's drawing this awesome toy village or something. And that's never stopped. He's drawn, you know, spaceports up, you know, like space stations and stuff. Things going on everywhere. I can't say enough about him. I guess the one thing is, I'm guessing Dark Horse has only printed out these three. And this last one, Walker of Monsters, continues on to the second one.
Oh.
And I don't think they ever put out the second
one. Don't you have four of those hardcovers of Rocco Vargas?
Well, I got the big one, which is the first four stories.
And then you got that one.
And then I got these three.
Wow, you're all Rocco'd out, man.
But, like I said, this last one goes to another one, and they never finished it. So, well, I mean, they finished it in Europe, I guess, but
I'm guessing
the sales weren't strong enough here. I don't know.
All right. Sounds good, man. What do you got there, too? You got the not for something completely different. ElfQuest.
One thing Al brought up was an old something that came out in the late 70s is ElfQuest. I'm guessing you brought it up. You're one.
Yeah.
You never really quite read them, though?
I read a few. I have some early ones, and I read them a long time ago. And I noticed yesterday I was at the comic book store that Marvel reprinted them in color.
Yeah.
There's a lot of them that Marvel reprinted in color, apparently.
The way it worked was ElfQuest was by a married couple.
Richard and Wendy Pini.
Yeah. Wendy was actually the artist. The way the whole thing started was she used to, somebody referred to her as a comic book groupie, but she...
She was Red Sonja.
Yeah, she played
with
Red
Frank
Sonja.
Thorne.
With Frank Thorne in conventions. I always heard about it and seen pictures. It was pretty neat, but there's a show on YouTube. We'll link it to the blog. But she also did a lot of illustrations for science fiction magazines like Galaxy.
Oh, she did? I didn't know
that.
Oh, okay.
And she was fantastic. It's kind of surprising me. I guess she was one of the first people doing cosplay. But she was also a good singer, dancer, all around. And her artwork is just par none. And but she saw that animated movie Wizards by Ralph Bakshi. And she just loved it. And then she started writing Bakshi, and she started working on an adaptation of the first movie for comics. And then she was going to do Wizards 2. You know, she was...
In comic book.
Well, she was talking to him about doing an animation.
Oh, okay. All
of course, right. That never went through. But at one point, her husband said, look, you know, why don't you make your own? Instead of doing something for somebody else, why don't you make up your own? And that's where this came about. I guess she was kind of scared because a lot of independent publishers are lucky if they even break even. But they went ahead and did it. The story I'm told is that they printed them up and they were talking to Bud Plant, you know, the distributor. And he said, yeah, I'll buy what you got off of you, so. And he did. Cerebus was the same way.
Yeah.
And these both came out about the same time. I found that in Wichita Falls, there was a comic book store called Wizard's Book Den. And the woman mentioned it. I never heard of it. So she gave me the second, third issue. And to me, it was like a religious experience. The way she drew, she's her own person, but it reminded me quite a bit of early Dave Cockrum.
Mm-hmm. I can see that.
And I just couldn't, but the story was just as strong as the artwork, and that's saying something. But there were large magazine-sized black and white comic books with pastel covers. And black and white in color, she was just fantastic. But the plan was they were going to do 15 issues, And it was going to have, as we talked last episode, a beginning, a middle, and an end. And it ended up being 20 issues.
Is that all of them?
That's the first series, yeah. It's all 20. But I guess you could kind of divide the story up into 5-issue arcs. But it midway through, it started taking on a different... When it actually went on the quest, it took on a completely different feel for it. And sometimes I think this is getting to be like a old Astro Boy comic or something. It finished, I think it started in 1978 or 79, and it finished in 1984. I just came back from overseas and got the last 2 issues of it. And it did end, but the ending kind of left me a little lukewarm. Like I was, it was a definite ending, but it just didn't have the same emotional appeal that the earlier issues had.
The end of the, because there was different storylines, so the end of the last storyline is what you're talking about.
Yeah, the first one. No, the first 20 issues.
Oh, okay.
Is the ElfQuest.
Wasn't there another storyline that happened
yeah.
after that one?
Yeah.
Okay. Because there was Escape on Blue Mountain or something on Blue Mountain.
Yeah, well, after the quest ended, that was in 84, and I think it was in 87, they did one called Siege at Blue Mountain.
That's a...
And it was regular comic book sized, and that cartoonist Joe Staton.
Inked it,
which...
And it was in... I think I have a graphic novel that was in color when I saw it.
Yeah, what they did was, I think the first... It was 4-issue, 4 books, trades, and they took 5 issues of each segment, and they put them in color. A company called Starblaze did it.
Yeah.
And I liked them. The first issue, the first book, Wendy Penny and Glennis Oliver, you know, who did Marvel coloring.
X-Men.
Yeah, they did it. And there's a lot of red in it, which I guess you complain. And the next book, that's when they were in the forest, there's a lot of green. The third one, I can't remember exactly, I think it was a lot of purples. And in the last book, it was a lot of whites and blues. It was really pretty. But anyway, the quest was those 20 issues. And like I said, it was a finish, and the series ended, and that was it. And I kind of was left with this... It's like watching Blade Runner when it first came out in 82, how it ended, and you're like, what? And then later on, I guess they both came out and was complaining about, you know, they finished. This is one of the few comic books that actually had an ending that anybody saw. And they got press all through ElfQuest, and all of a sudden they ended it, and not really much of a peep. And they were kind of irritated about it, which I understand, but I have to admit, I was one of them. I didn't really quite know what they, you know. And then, like I said, it was 3 years later, they put out Siege of Blue Mountain. I got them. I liked it. I just didn't like it as well as the regular series. And I do like Joe Staton, but I didn't like him inking Wendy Penny. But then they did another series when that ended called Kings of the Broken Wheel. And it was fine, but about halfway through, I don't know what it was, but it just kicked into overdrive, and it was, to me, just like the earlier issues, the story had that emotional feel, and I couldn't wait to get another issue. And then from there, she put out on the ElfQuest, The Hidden Years, which was done in color and pastels, and those were beautiful, and the stories were just as strong as anything else, and I was getting really excited about the strip again. And then they expanded the line where they started letting other artists like Leah Hernandez, Barry Blair, and a whole bunch of other ones do their own stories. And then I guess they kind of made an anthology of it, and that's when I kind of stopped reading it.
What was that, in the 2000s or the 90s?
The 90s.
She hasn't done it in a while, right?
Well, I know she was always working on doing, you know, there was always something that works about an animated feature or movies. For some reason, I want to think CBS was picking it up for an animated thing in the 90s, but maybe I'm wrong. But she's always had other projects. I know sometime in the 2000s, when manga was so popular, DC set up a deal with them where they were going to put out ElfQuest in manga-sized books. And I saw one time at the store. I never saw any kids reading it. But I see where they were thinking, but what was a big selling point in the original series? I remember the Comics Journal and people were talking about it was how large the artwork was. You know, it was magazine size. And you got magazine size pages brought down to, you know, itty-bitty manga
pocketbooks. Yeah, it loses, it gets muddy or something.
And but it's kind of odd. It was a strip that was just so immensely popular. In the 80s, I turned so many people onto it, you know. And I just got a note from Facebook from some woman I went to college with, and she said she just found these and can't wait to read them again. But it's just almost a forgotten strip, you know.
Yes, it is a forgotten strip, yeah. It was one of those things that was very popular in the 70s and 80s and into the 90s as well. But it's just, I mean, you would think with all the Tolkien stuff, it would gather steam again. But it's kind of like lost in a way. They really didn't do much. Like you said, they didn't do much with it as far as translating it into television or working into other mediums or whatever. It was a comic, graphic novels, and that was it. I'm wondering if that has something to do with, you know, the business behind ElfQuest or whatever. I mean, I could be wrong, but I've heard stories that maybe, like, you know, the husband was a little difficult to work with or something like that. I'm not 100% sure, though. So.
Well, what was that? Colleen Doran.
In,
I guess, 84, they started Warp Graphics, which is their company, which stood for Wendy and Richard Penny. They started doing other people's work. And I guess, I can't think of his name, it's Phil Foglio, I think.
Yeah, Phil Foglio, yeah.
He was he had a book called Myth Adventures, which I guess is, it was adapting Robert Asprin's work into comic books.
I remember that, yeah.
And the other was a strip by this woman named Colleen Doran called A Distant Soil.
Right.
And it was done all in pencils with shading. But she wrote and drew it. I picked them up. And it kept my interest. I think she did two or three issues. And then
she did a few, yeah.
But somebody, I've never read this, she was in Amazing Heroes or something, did a write-up, and somebody mentioned to me that I guess she was bullied by Richard Penny, was what she kept complaining about. And I heard her on an interview somewhere. She never really quite alluded to it, but she still has problems with him.
Yeah.
I don't know.
He's the businessman, you know?
So I don't know what any of that is. I do know that when the two of them talk, it seems like everything's fine. They're happily married people, and I like their work. And he's always said Wendy does most of the work, but he puts a lot of it into it, you know, story-wise, you know, planning it out. So I don't know, but they do own the stuff lock, stock, and barrel. And I know when they did CG Blue Mountain, it was under Apple Comics, which I guess is some company I never
heard. Yeah, I remember Apple Comics. Boy, you see, the thing is, a lot of those publishers died out.
You know,
Aardvark Vanheim or whatever, you know, or what was the one that Denny Lubert had? I think she was
Renegade.
Renegade Press, yeah, all those guys. They kind of died out in the 90s to be replaced by Image, and, you know, these are the, we should explain, these are all black and white comics.
Yeah. But the Marvels you're talking about, what happened was Marvel had an Epic line, which is creator-owned comics.
Was ElfQuest, did they show up in Epic?
Yeah, what happened was Epic was, you know, it was comic store direct market only. It was on really slick paper, nice packages, some of my favorite comics. But then they did a deal with Sergio Arganez, who had the comic book GRU. And GRU was a regular newsprint comic book that he owned. It was through Epic. But they put it out on the newsstand distribution, which is a big plus for him. And it went so well that they did ElfQuest. And on ElfQuest, they took the actual black and white magazine, turned it into a four-color comic book. But she added pages, you know, just to break them up into the chapters properly. So there was new splash pages, you know. Each issue had two or three pages, sometimes one. But it completely serialized into 22-page comic books. And I don't know how long it went on. I bought a few issues. I preferred the black and white or even the color trades because, you know, they were larger and it was the way she originally put it. I never really quite read them with all the new pages.
I saw them in comic store. They had a pretty good run of the Marvel ones.
Yeah. But I don't know if the Marvel run did the other series. I think it was just that first ElfQuest series.
Plus, she was one of the first big female comic book creators as far as having her own book and doing well financially and all that stuff. So she kind of was a trendsetter in that sense or whatever.
Oh, she was fantastic. I loved her artwork.
I like it more than I did when it came out. appreciate it more now.
You and I have a different sensibility.
Completely different. Except for some artists.
Well, we both...
I'm more of a realistic, traditional. Yeah. You're more cartoonish.
And this right there was exactly what
this
I was
This is a combo
for.
Of both, though.
Yeah.
It's got realistic, kind of like inking and shading, but the characters look a little cartoony.
Well, it looked like the old Astro Boy type stuff in a
way.
Yeah,
a little like manga, you know. A little bit.
Well, she loved that kind of work like I did. But she was better at doing it.
She definitely made a career out of it. She probably made a lot of money off these.
Yeah, and still owns it.
I still hear
talk that, you know, somebody's looking at it and stuff. Again, it's like now you go to a convention and you see all that Adventure Time for the comic book. You see people dressed up and, you know, and which is, it's a cartoon I love. And I like some of the comics. I probably like all the comics if I got them. It's well deserved, but in the 70s and 80s, it was ElfQuest that held that spot.
ElfQuest and Cerebus with the two big black and white books.
But ElfQuest was huge, and it had a wide audience. It had a wide female audience as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And now, like I said, it's you don't see it. You don't see any reference. It just disappeared.
And it's funny because they both have kind of a reference, big reference to Red Sonja in them. Because she was Red Sonja on the shows, and he had a Red Sonja character in the early Cerebuses.
Did he really?
Yeah, the very early Cerebus were a takeoff on Conan.
Yeah. Red Sophia.
Red Sophia, yeah. So it's weird how like Red Sonja kind of like is involved in a weird way in both of these two comic book series, I should say.
Yeah, and actually, I think they had the Wizard in that, too.
Uh-huh.
And I think he was kind of a takeoff of the show.
Frank Thorne, yeah.
But I think Dave Salmon's Cerebus, he was doing a takeoff of that show because when Red Sonja walked, it had that boom, ba-doom, ba-doom.
Yeah, right, I remember that.
I always
that.
Took it as a reference because I'm told that that show that they did had dance and songs and stuff in it, I don't know. I guess I just have always imagined myself trying to do something like that, and it'd be embarrassing, but...
Yeah, you mean dress up as Red Sonja?
Well,
yeah, I don't want to see that.
Trying to dance and entertain people, but...
Well, you know who also did that earlier on was Von Bode. He had that cartoon concert.
Yeah.
And there's a clip of it, or used to be a clip of it on YouTube, but you could look it up or whatever.
Well, it's on one of the old episodes we talked about Von Bode.
Yeah. He had a show.
And that was another one. He said he was doing the voices and showing slides, and I just thought... Again, I just always imagine somebody getting, okay, I know he said.
Oh, no, no.
But, yeah, Von Bode, it was very entertaining, and he carried it. And, well, there's a YouTube clip of The Wizard and Red Sonja. The film's really bad. It was done on an old, but...
16 millimeter or something.
And it went on for a while, and I got tired of watching it because some of it would just disappear. But still, they carried the show, both of them. They're both great artists and writers. They're also great entertainers. So
yeah, Bode died in 75 or 74. If he would have continued on, I think he would have had a successful comic book, independent comic book. I wouldn't put it past him.
I wouldn't have either, because he published things right and left.
Uh-huh.
And, they say there was a magazine, because he worked with National Lampoon.
Yeah.
And
Cheech Wizard.
There's, what do you call it? He had other things in there as well.
That's the one I remember.
Yeah, that was the big one. But he had a magazine called Von Bode, and it had mock-up covers and everything, but it was, you know, a magazine he was going to run. And then he died, and a couple of years later they put out Heavy Metal.
I have a paperback somewhere called Bode's Cartoon Concert, and it's like Cheech Wizard and all of his characters, it's kind of neat. So I would have thought that he would have been right up there with these two guys.
A
little more adult, but...
Like I said, he was a great artist and writer, and very good at conceiving things.
Oh, yeah.
It never seemed to stop with him. He reminded me a lot of Wally Wood. I think Wally Wood was a big influence on him.
Probably.
And the way he drew all the machinery and the military stuff.
Well, Bode was in the military.
Yeah, exactly. I got some of his journals that he...
Yeah, he was in the military,
But I think he was also a publisher, an editor and publisher, besides being a cartoonist. So he had a business sense to him.
I think he would have been there.
You're right.
I think so. I mean, because these guys started She said you started. Those are what, 79? You said the first ElfQuest.
No, 70. I think it came out 78, but I think that first issue somebody else published was 77.
And Cerebus was around that time too,
yeah,
wasn't it?
They both started around the same time.
Yeah. Oh, well.
And like I said, Bud Plant was the one that said, oh, I'll grab them, and he was selling them on the side, which really helped them out, and they got to be a big thing. When I saw it in Wichita Falls, that was the only store I saw it at. And then years later, the store in Oklahoma City started carrying them, and then it got to be a thing where everybody carried ElfQuest.
All right, Don. It's time for a break, I think.
All right, who are you going to play?
I don't know. We'll figure that out, and we'll let you know who it is when we get back.
That you may see the meaning.
All right, we're back. That was 801 Live doing the Beatles classic, Tomorrow Never Knows.
I have to admit, I've never heard of these guys. Can you tell us about them?
Phil Manzanera, guitarist for Roxy Music.
Oh, yeah.
And Brian Eno was actually in this band. This was formed after Roxy broke up, and he put out a live album. And then Manzanera went out and put out a few albums on his own, and he had members of Splend singing on them. So
was Brian Eno on Roxy Music as well?
Brian Eno was in the first two Roxy Music albums.
See, that's
and he left.
I know the name, but I've never really, I don't know of any of their music.
He left because of personal difficulties with Brian Ferry. It was like two stars. You know, one of them was doing the synth on one side, the other one was doing the songwriting, and they clashed, and, you know. It was better for both of them, actually.
Yeah. Well, there was another band like that that I had never heard of until somebody was showing me Musician Magazine. And, who were those guys? Andy Warhol was involved with them?
The Velvet Underground.
Yeah, Velvet Underground. That's another
Lou Reed.
One. Yeah, Lou Reed.
Yeah, that's like junky music, kind of, sort of. I remember one guy who saw him back in the 60s said, yeah, that was the band where all the junkies went to. And I was like, wow. I kind of like them, though, but I'm not into that crap.
Okay,
so,
but you know. This band you just played, a little bit more, besides Brian Eno and that other guy was in the band?
Who else is in it? Okay, the drummer for Roxy was in it, Paul Thompson, and I think a guy called Francis Monkman is in it. I'm not sure if he's the keyboardist or I forgot who else was in it, but it was just five guys. It was just guys that were in Roxy and Eno's band, and they got together and they did a live album.
So basically, Roxy Music without Brian Ferry.
Roxy Music and Friends without Brian Ferry, yeah. But doing covers and a few original songs from Manzanera's solo album called Diamond Head.
And this time they did a Beatles song or John
Finale,
Lennon song.
John Lennon song. Beatles. They're all. Well, are they all on that song? Or is that just John Lennon and George Martin?
No.
Tomorrow Never Knows.
No, it was the whole band.
They were all playing
and
on it.
That was
it.
The first song Jeff Emmerich worked on when he became an engineer.
Okay.
But all right. It was all four of them.
Welcome to Two Dimension Musical Podcast.
I read a book.
That is a good book, by the way, The Beatles Sessions.
No, it is. That's one of my favorite books. But no, this is a book. I can't remember the title. It was written by Jeff Emmerich, as the recording sessions was, but it was his story and how he got into the music industry. And then he was working at EMI. He'd seen the Beatles. He'd sat in on one of their early, right before the first album came out, but he wasn't the engineer. He was just a young assistant, junior engineer or something. But then it was while they were starting Revolver, the engineer that George Martin had left to become Pink Floyd's producer.
Norman Smith.
And so they brought Jeff Emmerich in, and then the Beatles came in looking around, and they said the Beatles were very funny about outsiders, you know, and Jeff Emmerich was an outsider. And John and George are kind of funny, and George says, you know, where's Norman? And I said, well, Norman's not here. And it's just that we brought in Jeff. And then Paul McCartney said, hey, good. You know, Jeff's a good guy. It'll be fine. And Jeff Emmerich said he had a feeling that George Martin and Paul McCartney kind of rehearsed this. And then George, John Lennon was talking about Tomorrow Never Knows. He said he wanted his voice to sound like he was a wise man at the top of a mountain peak alone. And, you know, George Martin was just thinking, how is he going to do that? And then Jeff Emmerich thought about it. I think there was a Walt Wurlitzer organ in there. And he started thinking, if he ran it through the speaker of the Wurlitzer organ and then ran it through something else recorded, it'd give that sound. So he told George Martin, and he said George Martin kind of furrowed his brows thinking of something else. Go ahead and try it. So he, you know, ran in there as a kid in a panic, you know, settle these things up. And then they started recording it. And then when the playback came, he said George Harrison looked at it through the window, gave him a thumbs up, and that's John Lennon said, that's exactly what I wanted. And so that was the first song Jeff Emmerich was on.
That's just a preview of our upcoming new blog, Two Dimension Musical Podcast, coming soon to a station near you.
Well, you
can be on the lookout.
You can read a better version if you just get Jeff Emmerich's book. That's not hard to find. Just look up Jeff Emmerich on one of the online sellers and get the book, and you'll.
Oh, listen to this transition that I'm going to. This is like professional show business here.
Yeah.
So, would you consider Jack Kirby to be kind of like the Beatles of comics in the 60s, because they were all around, they were all at the same time, they were doing incredible, like, world-changing, you know, books and music and literature or whatever. I consider him to be the Beatles of comic books.
I think if Jimi Hendrix was in the Beatles, you'd have Jack Kirby.
Even better. Oh my gosh.
I do think the synopsis, the Beatles, because they changed everything.
So did Jack.
And the thing is, it's
game
hard,
changers.
Well, it's hard to imagine that you can have that many good albums all the way through, so different.
Yeah.
But yet, you still can't stop listening to them. And, They still stand up. Every one of them.
Yeah, and, definitely.
You know, but Jack Kirby, like I said, I don't know how anybody could do that much work and do it well. And his style changed. The early Kirby looks much different. That was something that fascinated me as a kid, is how he came up with that Marvel style that, you know, even progressed even further when he's doing the Fourth World stuff for DC. But it was this strong, bold graphic style. But even when people talk, like, you know, one thing that bothers you is when he went back to Marvel, he said the magic was over. I'll agree, but there was still enough in it, because if you see those old Black Panther comics, just the stuff he was putting in there, he wasn't phoning it in. But yeah, there was nobody like Jack Kirby. The reason we're even talking about it, I've always loved the Fantastic Four. I've never read it all the way straight through. I find reprints, and I think, man, this is fantastic. Once in a while, I find an old issue. And so I've been buying these old masterworks. And I haven't read them, because I wanted to read all of them in consecutive, and I'm still missing a couple. But I got the Masterworks number 6. And I just got in the mail Tuesday. I'm in the middle of reading other things. I had to go to the airport to pick somebody up. Came in the mail, opened it up just to thumb through to see what it looked like, and next thing you know, I'm sitting there reading it. I'm almost late to the airport. After I picked the person up, I came back. I read the whole thing, and I just could not put it down. And I'll tell you, the artwork is hitting on all cylinders. The story was hitting on all cylinders, and in this one, even the introduction by Stan Lee is hitting on all cylinders. And when I say that, and a lot of people love Stan Lee, and they enjoy that, but a lot of times when I read stuff he writes, it's a lot of nothing. He doesn't really say a lot. He's just, you know, hey, and hyping things up, but he doesn't really say too much. This one, and I understand this. He says that, you know, he doesn't have the best memory, and which, okay, I'll give him, but I guess they had him kind of look through the stories before he wrote this. And then he was just talking about Jack Kirby and Joe Sinnott and what they did, and giving them full props and full credit, which is rare from anything I ever read from him. And he was talking about things he liked and why he put them in there. But I really enjoyed that introduction. It was fantastic. And then the stories, it leads off with one of the most famous Fantastic Four stories, which I have never read, called This Man, This Monster. And that, it was full of feeling. The artwork was strong, but I mean, I do think Stan Lee had a lot to do to that story, and it says a lot in there, and it just never stopped. The introduction to Black Panther, one of the greatest characters I've ever read in my life.
And soon to be a picture, I think. Soon to be a movie, I think.
Wesley Snipes always wanted to play that character.
He's in jail now, isn't he?
But I'm sorry, because he would have been great. The thing about the Black Panther, it's just a guy in a black suit with pinstripe gloves and boots. You don't even see his face, but yet it's just how that character is and how he stands and how he moves. He's just amazing. And then I love the fact that, you know, he was a king of, you know, Wakanda, which I guess is the only place you get vibranium.
That's right. I forgot about that.
The most
that,
precious resource. And But he was one of the richest men and one of the most intelligent men in the world. And it's funny because it looks like a really neat African village. Has all the tribal stuff and all that, but then underground and behind all the mountains is all this super futuristic machinery and technology. So it was like a race of people living in the past and the present, all in harmony. But T'Challa, you know, the Black Panther, he had a dignity in the suit, he had a dignity without the suit, and he was just fantastic, you know.
Who else did they introduce? Didn't they introduce the Inhumans in that run?
I think the Inhumans came a little bit earlier. They mentioned
a little
them.
Earlier. Okay.
They're in it all over. The Silver Surfer, Dr. Doom's in it together. That's, I think that's one of the issues that brought you into the book when you
57,
were
57, yeah. Issue 57, that was
Claw's
the one.
In it. But the Inhumans is running in it all through it. Wyatt Wingfoot.
Wyatt Wingfoot, that was the other guy. Is he still around?
He pops up at times.
He does, okay. All right.
You know, he was seen on She-Hulk in the 80s. John Byrne put him back in the strip.
That's right. Yeah.
The thing about Wyatt Wingfoot, after the...
American Indian.
Yeah. After the Galactus trilogy, you know, which that ended, to me, was the high point of the Fantastic Four. Well, I say high point, but it didn't stop, because then he introduced the Black Panther, they introduced the Inhumans, it just kept going, which is unthinkable. But Johnny Storm, the Human Torch, went to college. And I did read that story in a reprint, and basically the dean was talking to both Johnny Storm and Wyatt Wingfoot, put them together as roommates, and the dean was explaining why. And he was telling Johnny Storm, you know, you're a man of unique abilities. Well, he was the Human Torch, you know, he'd been everywhere. And then he started talking to Wyatt Wingfoot. And when he was doing that, you know, Johnny Storm, it had word balloon or thought balloons. He was thinking about, you know, Crystal and everything. I don't know, whatever else he's doing. And then it came back, what? I was thinking about that when he was talking about Wyatt Wingfoot's special abilities. I don't know what they are. And I was wondering, because he was basically a civilian with a Fantastic Four. I never knew if they answered or not, but in these books, they do show he was a very resourceful human being. And he, even though he didn't have any, you know, superpowers, he took care of everything. Fantastic character. I don't think anybody ever wrote him the way they wrote him in these old stories. But yeah, it's just...
Well, the reason I make the comparison is because around this time, both the Beatles and Kirby Kirby Marvel Comics, whatever, were doing things that were kind of mind expanding. You know, they're going into like all sorts of strange, weird realms that like a year or two before they weren't even attempting to do. You know, I mean, this went into the negative zone and started going into all sorts of like strange. You know, Alien, you know, him came out, Adam Warlock came, like, out of a few years
exactly.
After this. Yeah, it started getting kind of really spacey or whatever, both of them at the same time. So I always, like, thought of the two of them as, like, kind of like the musical peak and the comic book peak.
I agree. And the thing that gets me about that was it seemed like both, you know, everybody in the creative team were putting everything they had into it, and... It
was a creative time.
It was challenging. It was just channeling everything. And, it never stopped. It was like all kinds of fantastic things. And that's the question I've always had, was why did they were given a good deal and good credit? And why did Jack Kirby never left Fantastic Four? That's something I always thought. Would it continued on like that?
It might have had the characters from the fourth world in it.
Well, absolutely. It would have had more of that. But I just always wondered, would it...
Quality level?
Yeah, would it... I mean, you know, you always have a peak.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, at the same time, there's a lot of rock bands where there's a certain album that you may think is the greatest, but yet they still put out other things that you enjoyed quite well, that you love.
I find most rock bands, except maybe the Beatles and, I don't know, a few others, they usually string, like, three or four real great albums in a row, and then it starts to get... wonky. Good songs every once in a while, but it starts like getting... it's not there anymore. Either they lose a member, or the songwriting starts to get repetitive, or that was all they had. You know?
Well, yeah. I mean, a friend of mine made a comment one time that every band has so much to say.
Yeah.
And I know his comment was Alice Cooper had everything he had to say in two albums.
Basically.
He continued to do albums people liked.
Killer and, Love It to Death, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, there's a lot of bands that did several albums after whatever made them big, and I still enjoyed them just as much. Like you said, sometimes members of the band, like The Who, they just continued until Keith Moon died, and they weren't bad, but it just wasn't quite the same, and
they had a good run, though, for a while there, of albums. all the way through. I think even the Who by Numbers was still a really good record.
I love that album.
But by the time they got to Who Are You, there were some good songs on that record, no doubt.
Well, see, I honestly think if Keith Moon had died, I don't think it would have. He lost it, even on that one.
He did. He was out of his mind.
Yeah, so.
I think he was, you know, I think somebody was telling me, was it you or somebody, there was a clip of him? No, it was Brian Yetter was telling me there was a clip. There's a show on TV I've never seen. It was called The Last 24 Hours, and it's about the last 24 hours of a famous person's life.
Hmm.
And there was one about the last 24 hours of Keith Moon. And they were saying that dude, I don't know if there was a clip or whatever, but he was like drowning like 7 or 8, like whatever the you know, sleeping pills to go to sleep. And then like 2 hours later, he'd wake up and he'd drop another 7 or 8 of them. His tolerance to that stuff was so high that it was, you know, it was inevitable that guy was.
Well, the alcohol he was drinking. I remember, he was drinking a bottle of something, and the doctor said, "You're going to have to cut this out or you're going to die." So he switched from a bottle of that to a bottle of something else.
Yeah, right.
Still continued to.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, you.
But yeah, you only have enough. I think Kirby would have been great for throughout the mid 70s with Marvel.
Yeah.
I think Kirby started, his artwork started to deteriorate more like in the early 80s maybe. I don't know if he had a problem with his eyesight or he was already getting, or maybe something with his coordination, but it was starting to go a little bit. It was still nice, but it was starting to go a little
bit. Yeah, the 80s, I thought. You know, the 70s, a lot of people. I even in that book, Marvel Comics, The Untold Story, they were talking about his, they were making fun of the books he was doing. You know, he was doing 2001, Devil Dinosaur, The Eternals. But honestly, I like those. Now, 2001 I would get, and sometimes I think, why am I buying this? But then I think the third and fourth issues, there was a two-part story called Marok about this barbarian that, you know, built an empire. I still, to this day, when I see that, I saw it at the store the other day, he was telling you. It's one of my favorite Kirby stories. I just can't put it down. And in 2001, he did The Machine Man, you know, a couple issues of that. And that's another one. It's just the whole idea of it, you know, building these androids that think like humans but didn't know who they were and was falling apart.
And now those characters would have been incorporated into the Fantastic Four.
But, you know, there was times where he was still hitting hard. I loved his Fourth World stuff. I liked Commandy. I loved Olmec, right there for DC. But some of that stuff he was doing to Captain America when he came back to Marvel, it was kind of creepy, like the Arn of Zola, you know, the whole biological stuff. But it was still, nobody else was doing things like it.
Now, why didn't Jack Kirby want to do Fantastic Four when he came back to Marvel?
I don't know.
I think it was offered to him.
Was it?
I think.
Yeah, because he did Captain America, and the rest of it he did.
He wouldn't do Fantastic Four.
I think he didn't want to do anything that he had done with Stan Lee. He did Captain America with
Stan
Lee.
He did Captain America. I don't know. I thought maybe he knew something.
No, I didn't. Okay. I never thought of that.
I mean, he did do the Silver Surfer trade paperback, which he showed in the last. And he also did What If the Marvel Bullpen, or what if, he did, well, What
yeah,
If.
It was a What If for the Marvel
FF,
Bullpen. Were the
FF or whatever, which is kind of silly fun, but it was fun. I liked it.
Yeah, I had it.
Yeah, so I just wonder, I think all these characters would have been incorporated into Fantastic Four, making it still an incredibly good comic book with a lot of ideas in it that were definitely, like, used up all over the place.
I still, like I said, I see. You know, Stan Lee made a joke in the opening of this that, you know, he was really being boisterous when he put the world's greatest comic magazine. But I have to say, he was right. It was the world's greatest comic magazine. And it was for a long time. And it ran for 102 monthly issues.
The Jack Kirby run.
And they never ran a repeat the whole time. It was 102 consecutive new issues. And I've heard criticism that, but basically some people say after the 70s, the issue 70s, that they weren't as good because Jack Kirby stopped putting in new things because I guess he's saving it because he was mad at Stan Lee and he was wanting to, you know, do something else. I still see issues I liked, but the thing is I still pick them up, even the 102nd issue. you open it up, and I love the drawing of it. You know, Johnny and Crystal's there with the thing, and Crystal was giving him some type of medicine. The thing's open his mouth with the spoon. He never got bad.
And he's so a professional.
If he was, you know, holding things back, he was holding things back like nobody else did. He was on something else.
I don't know how much he was holding back on purpose. You know what I mean? Yeah. I mean, I wonder about that. It may have been talked about in in one of the Kirby collectors or something like that, but I don't know.
Well, you know, the argument I've always had, and if you've heard this show before, you know how I feel about it, but Stan Lee was taking credit for everything, and that wasn't the case. I honestly always saw Jack Kirby doing the lion's share of the work. But on Facebook, somebody was talking about something with Jack Kirby, and then Roy Thomas came on, and he said, well, this is, listen, you can sit there and, you know, he said, you can't argue with the fact that Stan Lee was taking credit for a lot of things, and Steve Ditko or Jack Kirby was actually coming up with these. He said, but that wasn't always the case. Stan was putting things forward, and he wasn't always just saying, here, do this and all that, the dialogue. I've always thought that, too.
Hmm.
And In this case, there were elements where Stan Lee had an idea and Paul even gave him more of a script and said, let's try
it. At times, yeah, I think so.
I think so, too. But I don't mind that. I just don't like the fact he took credit for everything and doesn't, you know, which in this book he did not. He gave full credit to him.
I'm just wondering if in the 70s, with Stan Lee's popularity doing all sorts of things, whether he would have, like, how much his input would have been in the book. Might have been even stronger Kirby input in the book if it had gone on. You know, maybe even another writer, you know, working with him or something like that. That would have been a different thing.
I guess to me, though, in that Marvel Comics Untold story, I guess what threw me was Jack Kirby was wanting to do books by himself his way. But Stan Lee always stayed with it, and they wouldn't let him. But then Jim Steranko came in out of nowhere, and they let him write and draw his own book and have full control.
Yeah.
And then later, you know, Jim Starlin did that after Kirby left.
Yep.
But they never let Jack Kirby do it. Well, Jack Kirby did books for DC that were nice, but he was missing somebody like Joe Simon or Stan Lee adding something. And
I'm wondering if they thought that maybe Kirby on his own was a little bit too far out, maybe.
Well, it's,
even though, but I take that back, because Starlin was pretty far out, but that was like mid-70s.
Yeah,
everything was far
know.
Out then.
Sometimes I think you kind of need some, you know, somebody to tell you
editorial.
You can't just eat chocolate all day long. You have to have other kinds of food, you know.
Yeah, that's true.
I guess that's the thing. Sometimes I think Kirby needed somebody to collaborate, even in a small way. And but like I said, I look at those books and I just think, how could you come up with all this stuff? The New Gods, the Promethean Galaxy, and he just never stopped. He was just...
Yeah.
Until the 80s came along.
All right, I want to talk about a comic book that I was reading, of course. I have to bring up War and comic books, and almost every podcast, as I always do. But I picked out an issue of Creepy from 1975 that I remember buying, and this is probably the same issue that I bought back then. Only a dollar for, I don't know, 70, 67 pages or something like that. But at any rate, I was going to read the whole thing, but I read two stories. One of them is called Escape Chronicle by Jose Ortiz and Bud Lewis, and the other one was Thrill Kill by Jim Stransom and Neil Adams. And I was going to discuss the stories, but I'd rather discuss the storytelling, because it's something that always kind of, you know, the more you read the books, the more kind of you say to yourself, well, why do the words and pictures work better with some storytellers than other ones? I always thought about that. It's some of these European artists that came over here. If there was possibly a language barrier that caused the storytelling to kind of conflict a little bit. Even though this doesn't conflict as bad, I look at this story and it's a very nicely drawn story. But somehow or another, it's about two characters basically, and after a while, it just becomes, you can't tell the difference between the two characters, and it becomes difficult to read. And that's like a real basic tenet to me of storytelling, is to be able to clearly know what character is what? You know what I mean? Now, again, beautifully drawn, an interesting story about, basically like a 1984 story about, you know, being like, you know, a computer, basically like being just another part of society where you're just a cog, whereas he meets another guy who's kind of like almost like a hippie where he's like free and can growing his own food and all that. But I don't know. It's just, and I remember seeing a lot of this in these magazines. And it was just kind of like style over substance. That's the only way I can say it. You know, now I go back here to this last one by Neil Adams, and it's an interesting story because it's about a shooter, serial killer on top of a building, just basically picking off people. And it's Adams at his peak or whatever, but everything is clear. The panels, the story, the text within the panel makes sense to me. It's clear and easy to read. And it's just like, yeah, it's always kind of bothered me. You know, what do you think about that? Do you think that American artists back in the day, not now, because I know now it's difficult, do you think they had a more clear style of storytelling than the Europeans did?
Yeah, I don't know, when you're bringing it up, I just started thinking about it. That's absolutely a cultural thing. But I wonder if Europeans are looking at American comics thinking that, you know, we're too simple and over-explaining everything.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm thinking that because when you read a European comic, it's definitely, the words are definitely meant to match the picture. And it's the same thing as a subtitled movie.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, I've seen subtitled movies where, like, they get to the point, but I'm reading them, and it's not the same words. They're saying something that I know isn't what is being written in English.
You know, when you're talking about that, all I think about was in the 80s, early 80s, National Lampoon. It had a movie theater. It had a silhouette of two guys sitting in the theater. You know, it had the screen, but it was actual photos of a French movie. It had this woman in a large hat and sunglasses, and at the bottom it had, you know, the subtitles of the screen. And this woman drives out to the country, and she's, you know, saying these kind of poetic things. And then she walks down the metal, takes all of her clothes off, takes the flower, and brushes the flower against all of her naked skin. And while this is going on, the one guy's like, "What is this? Why are you bringing this? This is stupid. This doesn't make any sense. Why is she doing this?" And then his friend says, "Well, what she's trying to say is, you know, in this movie, they're making a thing about how she's leaving the urban decay of the city and coming out of the country. She's refreshed." You know, he's just, it's all artistic, you know,
yeah,
nice
yeah,
and
yeah,
poetic.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he goes, "What's she doing with that flower?" And he starts explaining more. He goes, "Hey, wow, this is great. This is the best movie I ever saw." And I think, when you're telling me this, To me, I like European comics. They're some of my favorites. I don't like all of them. But
yeah. I do, too.
Some of them, the Mobius stories.
Valerian, I like Torpedo, Jordy Burnett.
And they're fantastic.
That.
And the Valerian was written by Pierre Christian. And he writes a lot about sociology and philosophy in the strips that I just, and they're great stories. They're high adventure, high concept stories. But it is a different reading sensibility. I always looked at Michael Kaluta's Starstruck the same way. It's not a casual read. When you read that, you have to really put yourself in it and pay attention. And whereas a lot of the American comics that I love, you can kind of read while you're watching TV.
Like the Fantastic Four. You can read that book and not have a problem understanding everything.
Absolutely.
Even though it's got concepts that are totally foreign, and totally, you can understand it clearly.
Well, you could still read and enjoy it when you were 9 or 10 years old.
That's Jack Kirby, though.
French comics, not always. It is a different story, Tom, but so is Japanese comics.
Yeah.
As a matter
definitely.
Of fact, that's one thing. In the late 70s, Marvel was trying to do a trade-off and put, you know, Marvel comics in Japan and Japanese comics here. And then they gave up, and I think somebody wrote that Stan Lee said it's just too much of a cultural difference. Well, in the early 80s or mid 80s, when they when First and Eclipse started bringing over those Japanese comics, I was reading an interview, and these guys said sometimes the problem is that you're going to have a panel with a character looking, you know, something and not saying a word. And they may have a word bubble with little dots going across but not saying anything. What does this mean? Well, reading enough of them, you start realizing they're pensive. They're thinking of something, but not really. They're just trying to figure something out. Whereas an American comic, they would have wrote a whole paragraph saying, well, I'm trying to figure this out. I
right,
remember
right.
the time when I was 8, and I saw that, you know. And I guess that was the thing the Japanese publishers in the late 70s said, that American comics are too much of this and not enough of that. So there is cultural differences you read in it.
Especially in the translation. I mean, this one story, the first story, is definitely an American-written story sent to a Spanish a publisher or the artist or whoever was representing, maybe a studio, and then somebody over there interpreting, you know. But I'm assuming that what they were interpreting was the directions for each panel and not necessarily the text that was going to go on. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming. I don't know how they work. I've seen scripts by Charlton Wright, I think it was Joe Gill, that was pretty much basically told you exactly, you know, what to draw on each panel, and then you know, he would tell you what the characters were saying. I'm wondering if there's like something's lost in translation, maybe.
Have you ever seen that? A European did it. It was Tarzan in Manhattan or Tarzan in New York.
No.
I've seen it a couple of times, like Comic Journal, you know, stuff like that. But it's drawn like if Tarzan was done in the Marvel Comics in the 60s. He wakes up in his hotel room in a loincloth. And he stands up and he's in a heroic pose, his arms up, he goes, I'm awake. And then he opens up the window and says, I must breathe in the air. And then he goes in the bathroom, brush my teeth. But it's all the Marvel style. Where
everything is over.
And that was something they talked about, was the difference in, like you mentioned, storytelling in Europe and the United States. And when I read that, I thought, well, yeah, actually, it's all in your face. It looked kind of silly in that context, but... No, I never thought of it. Like I said, I guess I've always mentioned the Spanish artists get really perverse. They're great artists, but they get really perverse. But, yeah, it's a different sensibility. I guess I just took it as that.
Well, have you ever read Valentina, the Italian strip?
No.
Okay, enough said. I'll see if I can find one of those. We talk about perverse, but, yeah, anyway... Because that was it's S&M stuff or whatever, but apparently really nicely drawn from what I remember, but yeah.
Yeah, they had a lot of those. Remember that Little Ego?
Uh-huh, yeah.
Really beautifully drawn. Looked like Little Nemo, but it was a woman walking around naked.
And there was one called something about Gwendolyn that was a British thing. That's pretty...
I don't remember that one.
That's pretty... I think it was British. It could have been American. I don't know. It could have been that guy that... You remember that? You ever hear about that guy that worked with Ditko called Eric Stanton?
No.
Oh, God.
When did he work with him?
In the 50s or 60s. Stanton and Ditko shared a studio.
Yeah.
I think it was in the 60s. It could have been in the late 50s. But Stanton was kind of a fetish artist. He drew dirty stuff, but, you know, like, I don't know, bondage or whatever. Mm. But him and Ditko shared a studio. Apparently... Ditko assisted him on strips. I never got the book because it was very expensive, and I'm not really into that crap that much or whatever. But there is some stuff in Stanton's book that it was illustrated, inked by Ditko, and it looks like Steve Ditko did it.
Well, where was this work published? That Stanton?
Originally it was printed in Men's Magazine. I'm pretty sure, but the volume that I saw was I think it was Glittering Images or Diva or something like that. But yeah, Eric Stanton's pretty notorious. But yeah, Steve Ditko did assist him with the art and did draw some of the panels. So it's very, it's very strange, you know, from you know, Mr. Conservative Objectivist Steve Ditko.
Well, yeah, but
that might have been before. Yeah.
Yeah, that, and also he's a professional artist.
Yeah,
so,
yeah,
you know,
he was helping out a studio.
So that would go with what he's doing. That he's got to help somebody out, and he was hired to do something. He did it. I could see that.
And he may have never even thought that nobody was ever going to notice. I mean, I'm assuming these guys didn't know they were going to become a big deal, kind of like a lot of people who make B-movies, thinking nobody's ever going to see them, and now they're all over the place. You know?
Well, yeah, but Steve Ditko in the 50s wasn't Steve Ditko that came later, and I don't think he ever liked the thought that he was well-known.
I don't either. I think he likes to be, like, stealth. Even though it helps that he's being well-known because of all the self-published stuff that he does to this day, he's still putting out books.
That's true.
All right, man. I guess we should wrap this up.
All right. Tell them about your online concerns.
Slow Robot A Go-Go.
Which you can find at?
Which you can find at bunchofdorks.com.
And you can also find our show from bunchofdorks.com, and then just click on Cyclops.
And all that good stuff. And you can go to Destination Nightmare blog, where I do my thing. And there's all sorts of goodies there, comics, movie reviews, podcasts. That's all I got, man. I don't think I can do any more besides Two Dimension, Slow Robot, and Destination Nightmare. I think I'm done with all that stuff.
Al's taking over the internet.
I'm trying.
If you are listening to us from anything besides the blog, feel free to go to bunchofdorks.com, click on the Cyclops.
And iTunes.
On iTunes. But if you see us on the blog, everything we talk about, we have examples of.
Yes.
Also links so you can find further information if you are interested.
And if you're not interested, still go on the blog.
But, like I said, a lot of times I hear people say, well, I listen to it, but I'm not really sure who this is. Well, that's fine. That's what we try to do, is bring up stuff that people might not have remembered. And, you know, there's always examples of it. And, again, there's plenty of stuff on the Internet about these people.
Yeah, we're trying to broaden your horizons, musically, artistically, and, you know, all that good stuff.
And if you do listen to us on iTunes and you like the show, please leave us a review. We'd really appreciate it.
Do we get any reviews? Have we gotten any?
No, we're still at 6.
Oh, God.
Which I appreciate, but, you know.
Come on.
Well, you know, saying that.
Come on, Company Ice, write a review.
Yes, to be on iTunes.
Yeah, Company Ice has gotten mentioned in 2 podcasts today, so. He's the reluctant member of Two Dimension. He's like on the sidelines.
Yeah, he always brings up stuff that we talk about, but he doesn't want to. He doesn't like to hear his voice recorded.
Which is fine. I have a hard time listening to mine. That's why I hardly ever listen to the show, but I do it, though.
So anyway, I guess that's all we have.
Is that all we have? Can't we talk anymore?
We could, but let's stop.
All right.
All right, well, since you played a band that covered a Beatles song, I'm going to do the same thing. This is Ringo Shaina from Japan.
All right.
And this is a John Lennon song.
Read more.
Come.
Yes, I'm lonely. Wanna die. the reason why.